I don't know what it is. Maybe that's it. But I'm an addict named Megan, and I'm really glad to be here, and thank you so much for asking me. I don't say no to Narcotics Anonymous. It was a little bit hard for me because I'm going to miss my home group to be here speaking with you. And if anybody knows, like, I don't miss my home group. If I miss my home group, like, I'm on a gurney, bleeding out, being life-flighted to a hospital somewhere. Like, it doesn't happen, right? But I decided that it was okay, right, because I'm being of service, right? But when Narcotics Anonymous asks anything of me, I say yes. No is not an option for me. And the reason it's not an option is because you have saved my life. And very much like somebody who would donate a kidney or donate something or like pull somebody from a burning building or whatever and save their lives in those ways, that person would be indebted forever, right? Or I imagine, you know, those people would feel indebted to that person and grateful. And, you know what I mean? Like, you, like, I'm alive because of you, right? So that's the exact same feeling I have because of all of you right now. I am alive because of you. And for that reason, like, I am indebted. I am obligated. It's a good obligation, right? It feels good. And I'm really glad to be able to give back in any way. So I don't say no. And I always start out by asking my higher power to help me carry some kind of a message of hope to at least one person here today. Just one. That's all I need. Please let it not be me. Some people say, oh, you know, when I give a lead, even if I crash and burn, right, like if one person in the room has helped, that's all that matters. And sometimes that person is me. And I'm going to ask my higher power right now, please not let it be me, because I've lived a life of self-service for so many years, right? And my goal now is to be of service to you, to my community, to my family, to the universe, and to the world always, right? Like abnegation, kind of like, you know, Meg's back here. I'm on the back burner, right? So let it be one person here, a message of hope. I heard a message of hope a long, long, long time ago in these rooms, and it stuck with me. And through 30 plus years of using. After my very first Narcotics Anonymous meetings, like, you were with me, and that message was always there, and I always knew that I could come back to you. And in some ways, it was a detriment because I would like push myself towards death more and more and more every day with the knowledge and the understanding. Well, they're there when I need them. I can always go back. I can always go back. I know they're there, right? My higher power saw fit to keep me alive so that I could return back to you. But, you know, in a way that was bad for me to like kind of, it might have kept me out there longer, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So, I grew up in a town called Aliquippa. I love Aliquippa. It's a wonderful little city, and it's decrepit, and it's a ghetto now. It's very sad, you know what I mean, what has happened to Aliquippa, but I love the place still. It's like my hometown, right? You love it in a way. Love-hate, kind of, that we have for the hometowns we grew up in. And I was raised by a family of addicts, a very loud, raucous, brawling, fighting, Irish, drinking, partying family. Right, and everybody was a mill worker. Jones and Laughlin Steel Company was the man, right? And everybody worked for the man. The entire town, 22,000 people, you know what I mean, lived in Aliquippa to serve LTV, or not, well, LTV eventually, but J&L. And we would joke that my family would joke that there were three shifts: one for working, one for sleeping, and one for drinking. You know, and that's the way we lived our life, and that's the way I grew up. And it was very normal for me. It was normalized. Alcohol and partying was a daily occurrence in my life. It wasn't weekends, right? It wasn't holidays. It was daily. It was a daily thing. If you weren't working, you had a beer in your hand, right? But very hardworking people, my family, they're wonderful people, you know. They're sad and sick in their own ways, you know, because of the addiction that's rampant in my family, but nonetheless, they're wonderful people. And I only came to that understanding of my family and who they are through working the steps, right? Because if you would have talked to me years and years ago, I might not have had such wonderful things to say about my family, right? And I can say that I suffered some abuse in my life, certainly some neglect, some profound neglect as a child. You know what I mean? Because when you're raised by partiers, you know what I mean? Yeah, they might throw you some food and make sure clothes are on your back, but that's it, right? And so profound neglect was definitely a part of my upbringing, and it wounded me and it hurt me, right? And I used those wounds, those childhood wounds, as a reason and excuse to use for many, 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 many years, right? And how wonderful that my medicine is right there. There's 12 steps, right? There's some medicine that helped me to heal those wounds, to be able to stand in front of you to say that any abuse and neglect that I went through as a child, honestly, it doesn't matter. None of it matters. And when I think about these people, all my heart just swells with love. When I think about my mom and my dad and my grandparents and my uncles and the whole wild, brawling lot of them, every single one of them, alive and dead, my heart swells. People very dear to my heart. But that's only through working the steps, right? So I urge you, right? I urge my sponsees, if you have some of these wounds, there is some medicine, and you can heal from that. It's very, very possible. And when you do, wow, feels really, really good. So yeah, that was my upbringing. And I was a little bit of a latecomer to using. Like, I didn't try my first drugs until 15 years old. And I think that's a latecomer because maybe it's early. I don't know. Maybe I think normal people do college, like college years or like high school is when they start to use drugs. But I've heard some people in here talk about like using at like 10 and 11 and 9 and stuff like that, right? So maybe I was a latecomer. I don't know. But it was about 15. And I drank beer and I smoked marijuana and I loved it immediately. Very first time, I was like, yeah, yes, love this, when can we do it again, right? Like, let's do it again tomorrow. And so my disease progressed very, very fast, okay? So I tried my first drugs at 15. By 16 in 1986, I was getting flip sign at 12-step meetings. 1 year. That's a really, really, really fast progression of the disease in a very young life, okay? So in 1986, when I was going to my first meetings, there were very, very few Narcotics Anonymous meetings back then. There were other fellowships, right? So a lot of my early years were spent in another fellowship, getting my slip signed and doing my thing, but it was really wonderful back then in the 1980s because, like I told you, my mom and my parents are addicts, right? And I suffered some abuse at their hands or whatever, you know what I mean, some traumas. And they certainly modeled for me how to use and how to be a good addict. They modeled for me, okay, I feel this and I don't like feeling this, so all I need to do is drink this and I don't feel it anymore. Right? They taught that to me. They taught me how to get by. That was the coping skill. Or I feel this, and I don't like the way I feel this, so I'm going to smoke this, and I won't feel that anymore. Right? So I learned that from them. I learned that skill, and I learned it very well. I was very good at it for a while. And but also, so in the 80s, my parents got clean too. Right? So they found the 12 steps. They found their medicine, and they got clean. Got clean. And so not only did they show me how to use, but they showed me how to get clean, right? So I got to tell that to my mom on her deathbed, you know, the gift that she gave me, you know, So I'm a very emotional person. I cry like on a dime. I cry all the time. I cry in my car listening to music. You know what I mean? Like lyrics for a song will move me, and I'm crying. You know, I'm at work. I work in addiction, so it's a very, very emotionally draining job, and I'm crying continually at work or whatever. But any mention of my parents, because I love them so much, and they're gone now. I mean, I haven't lost them. When I feel my heartbeat, I feel them. You know, but they're not here physically with me right now because they passed away. I get very emotional talking about my mom and my dad and those who passed on. So, the things that my parents modeled for me how to get clean. So in the 80s, when I was a teenager, we were, you know, going around to dances and conventions and campouts and picnics and dances. There were a lot of dances back then. I don't know. A lot of dances, it seemed like. So I learned, they taught me, you know what I mean, that there was a good life without the use of drugs. So I went to college eventually. And when I went to college, you know, I stopped coming to the rooms. And I went full-fledged, hard-on with my addiction, and I eventually dropped out of college and just went on tour with the Grateful Dead. And that was a glorious, wonderful time in my life. I mean, it was ripping and running, right? But I certainly, you know, it was a really good time. But I traveled all over the country and used a lot of drugs, partied the whole way, and really felt that at one time, like, I had a family or, like, some kind of an acceptance into the band of gypsies that I was running with, right? But in like, a hippie community or whatever, as long as you're doing, there's almost like a hierarchy of drugs, isn't there? Right? And, like, people, like, certain stigmas are associated with certain drugs, right? A drink is a drug, is a man is a cookie. That's what my sponsor says to me all the time. Right? Doesn't matter. A drink is a drug, is a man is a cookie. But society and addicts ourselves, like, we have a hierarchy or some kind of a, like, well, I'm not that bad, right? But I was always looking for something outside of me to make me better. I was always looking to identify with a group of people or be a part of, right? And so I was always very susceptible to like groupthink, if you will. Brainwashing, essentially, right? And as a teen, you know what I mean, it was like punk rock, right? Mohawk, Raging, Underground Railroad, you know what I'm saying, like hardcore. In my 20s, I found a hippie community and really really went hard with the hippie community, but I soon fell out of favor with the hippie community because I started using needles, right? And in the hippie community, as long as you're doing mushrooms and LSD and mescaline and smoking marijuana and everything, it's all good, right? That's all good. The second you bring white powder into it, you know what I mean, that's not good. You know what I'm saying? So, you know what I mean, that's where I found myself. That's where my addiction progressed to, right? And that was in the mid-90s, right about the point when Jerry Garcia died in 1995, right? So, I was kind of like, I don't want to say like expelled from the community, but I kind of, because of where my addiction went. And then I found a cult, right? So spirituality, like a search for spiritual meaning, and is definitely a part of my story. And I always wanted to identify, I always needed to be a part of. And I spent a lot of time in my travels and my life in temples, in mosques, in synagogues, and exploring different religions. And so I found what I thought was something that really spoke to me. And before I knew it, like unbeknownst to me, You know what I mean? I was like, I was in a cult. I was in a cult. And the hierarchy of drugs existed there too. And once my my addiction got so bad, I was banished from the cult. So in a cult, you know what I mean? Like, the people are, they're trying to keep you there, right? My addiction was so bad and I was so out of hand, they were like, no, go.
Yeah.
Go. Really, you need to go. You know what I mean? Like, you're disrupting the status quo here, you know what I mean, with your certain brand of craziness, you know? And that was devastating for me. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that rejection that's being cast out. You know what I mean? From like a family of sorts. It ultimately was one of the greatest gifts that my higher power ever gave me, right? Because what actually ended up with this group of people that I was in is a horrific story, you know? And I was saved from that fate by my higher power by being banished or whatever. But it was very, very hard for me. And I want to say that during this period of my life and during these searches for meaning, because like each little like snippet of my life was almost like another little chapter, another search for a meaning. Like, where can I find meaning outside myself this year? You know what I'm saying? This year it's going to be on tour with the Grateful Dead, right? The next year it's going to be practicing high ceremonial magic in a cult, right? The next year after that it's going to be, you know, smoking DMT on raspberry leaves with the Church of the New Inner Light in New York City. You know what I'm saying? So I kid you not. It's so funny. I know, it's so funny, but this is real, right? So in our literature, what it says, like, medicine, religion, and psychiatry, not sufficient for us. Not sufficient. Doesn't say that it's not, I don't know, for me, personal meaning, like, medicine, religion, and psychiatry are definitely a part of my recovery, right? They're coupled with the 12 steps. They're not sufficient alone on their own. And I tried my entire life to find meaning through medicine, religion, and psychiatry, right? But it's not sufficient. Not, doesn't make me whole. But with the 12 steps, I can supplement medicine, religion, and psychiatry, which are things that I need in my life. You know what I mean? I am made whole. So I always looking for something else. Always, you know, on a new path, a new endeavor. You know what I mean? Like, how can I be whole? How can I be Meg? And throughout this time, I continually came back to you over and over and over and over again. And every time I came back to you, you were there for me every single time. And the hug was still there, and my seat was there. Right? You never banished me. You never said, you know what? Your particular brand of crazy is too much. You need to go elsewhere. We need to protect ourselves from you. That never happened. You were always, always there for me throughout all of this. And I would come and I would get key tags and I would stay clean for 9 months and then I would use. And I'd go out for a year. And then I'd come back and I'd stay clean for 2 years. And then I'd use. And I'd come back 9 months later and I'd stay clean for 3 months. And this is, I'm talking like 20 years of this, right? I was rooted in the program, but there was something missing. I kept using. I kept relapsing. So there's chronic relapsers out there, right? My experience was is that nobody ever turned me away. The experience that I see sometimes in my area and in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous today, my experience, because I've witnessed it, is people becoming so frustrated with the chronic relapsers that they kind of do the, you know what, I just need you to, you know, keep that over there, right? I urge you, if you're feeling that way, if you're feeling frustrated with the chronic relapser who won't put it down, don't let your hug slacken. don't. Hug them tighter. Okay? That's what they need. In my experience, the hug was always there. And guess what? I'm alive and I'm here today because it was always there. So the chronic relapsers are my people. I understand you. This is a part of who I am. And certainly, people come in and get clean and they never use again. And wow, yes, phenomenal, right? Be there for that person that could, you know what I mean? Like share that experience and that hope and that strength that was your story. Wasn't my story. You know, and we all have a different story, and we have to be all inclusive and ready and willing for anybody and what their story is and be a part of their story, help keep them alive. So I think in 1997, I was strung out again, and I found myself pregnant and with my oldest son, Odin. And Odin is just talking about Odin earlier. Got some stuff going on with Odin right now. He's 19 years old. 19 is a hard age, I guess. And pregnant and strung out. I can either keep using or I can ask for help, right? Had to go to the professionals and ask for help, okay? So the professionals tell me, okay, we need to put you on methadone. That's what we do to pregnant mamas. We save that baby, right? In order to save the baby, we need to have you on methadone, right? So I'm like, okay, you know, I don't, right? One of the rare times in my life that I was willing to say, I don't know, please help me, and follow instructions. I did what the professional said. And I kept going to meetings on methadone, right? And guess what? Nobody said a goddamn word to me about it. Nobody said, you're not clean. I wasn't picking up pee tags, right? But nobody said, you're not clean, Megan. You're on methadone. Nobody said, oh, you're just substituting one drug for another. You're just... Nobody gave me their opinion. Okay? The opinions don't matter here. You take your opinion and go fly a kite with it. Right? Opinions don't matter. Nobody offered their opinion to me about the fact that I was on methadone but still coming to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. Not one single person. And I'm really, really grateful for that. But guess what? I'm not here to be on a soapbox. I already did a soapbox about one thing already. But very often, I come into the rooms these days and I hear a lot of opinions about people on medicated assisted treatment. Guess what? I'm alive today, and my child is alive today because of medication assisted treatment. That's my experience. I lived it. Okay? It's not an opinion. And I can share that with you in this meeting. We can talk about my opinions after the meeting, right? I'm very confident and like I'm full of myself, and I'll tell you how I feel. You know what I mean? But in here, nobody gave me their opinion. But very often in meetings, at least in my area, I hear opinions a whole lot. And I hear opinions a whole lot, and I hear a lot of judging, and I hear a lot of pushing people out, right? But if it's not your experience, no business even talking about it in the meeting, at least between the readings, right? Doesn't belong there. Anyway, so I'm pregnant and strung out on methadone, kept going to meetings. After O was born, and he had to detox in the hospital. And they give babies a little opium drops to help quell their symptoms, right? While they're detoxing from the methadone. Now it's Subutex that they give women, safer than the methadone even. So I was with O, and I said to him, O, you're detoxing right now, and I'm going to do it with you. There's no way that I'm going to let my baby boy detox from this drug and me continue to go get the drug. Like, we were in this together. We got addicted together. We saved our life. I helped save your life. We did this together the whole time. So you got to come off the methadone, and I'm going to come off it too. Right? And so I went to the clinic, and I said, you know, my boy's going to detox in the hospital, and I'm going to detox right along with him. And they were like, ah! You know what I mean? Like, no, can't do that. Blah, 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 blah. You'll be out there using it. And I was like, no, this is the time that my hard head came into play. I'm going to do this. You're the professional. I get it. However, I'm making this decision. So Odin and I detoxed together. It was a very fast detox off of methadone. It was difficult. It was hard, right? But as long as I had a little baby boy tremoring in the hospital in a little bassinet, there was no way that I was going to not do that with him. So we detoxed together, and I got a good 3 years clean after that. Was going to meetings, lived a really, really good life. Yeah, all the rewards of recovery were coming to me. I was serving, I was going to meetings, this and that, the other thing, and I relapsed. Do you know why I relapse every time? When I think back about it, about all these relapses that I had, I became disconnected and I stopped going to meetings. That's why I relapsed. The other things became more important. Career, school, family, you know what I mean? I put other things before my recovery, always. That 30 years of experience of relapsing, 30 years, every single time, something came before recovery. You know what I mean? I just started going to less and less meetings. Eventually, I'd get to the point where I was just going to my home group. At least I was going to my home group. Always was at my home group, right? But that was it. Once a week, going to a meeting, right? Stop calling my sponsor. A few weeks sometimes would go by before even calling her. You know what I mean? I wasn't actively working on a step, right? So, like, really didn't need to call her all the time, you know? Like, where's the need? Like, I had some clean time under my belt. I wasn't like a newbie. I didn't need to check in every day, you know, like we do in early recovery. But at any rate, that's my experience. My experience is always that something else came before my meetings. Something else came before my recovery. Very often it was work and my career and other demands in life. But, I got some clean time after Odin and I detoxed together, and I got some clean time, and I used again, and it was about 2001, and in a 3 month span, I had done a lot of damage, right? It was a 3 month, after about like 2-3 years clean, it was a 3 month run. I did a lot of damage, and I asked my sister for help. My sister's name is Amanda, and Amanda's journey was similar to mine. Amanda had a lot of clean time at one time in this, through your help. And I asked Amanda for help. I called her and I said, Amanda, I'm strung out and I need some help. And she said, okay, what do you need? I said, I just need help. I don't know what I need. I just need help. And she worked at the time as like a nanny for a man who was a high-level administrator in the White Deer Run Cove Forge family of treatment centers. And she called him and said, hey, my sister is an addict and she relapsed and she needs some help. I didn't have medical insurance at the time. And the SDAs weren't funding people back then. I mean, they didn't even really exist back then to get people into rehab. And he said, okay, you know what I mean, have her show up here or whatever, and they gave me a full ride, right, because of, like, who she knew. Wonderful man. And I went to rehab at, it was in Mount Pleasant. It was a White Deer Run facility. It was an all-women's facility, and it's not there anymore. It's burnt down. It's a huge, big, beautiful old mansion. The loveliest place in the world. Such a lovely place to be, to recover and to convalesce from the damage that we had done to ourselves. And I stayed there for like 30 days, and after that, in 2001, 5/15/01 was the last night day I used. That was my longest period of clean time. I got 8 years clean, and during that 8 years clean time, in the 2000s, from 2001 to 2009. The rewards of recovery that I experienced were so numerous. I still today enjoy the benefits of the rewards that came to me during that period in my life. And I was very involved with Narcotics Anonymous, and this is where my service really took off, and I really became rooted in the program, and eventually I went back to school, I got a career, the rewards of recovery just kept coming and coming and coming and coming, and life was so good, right? It's really, really good. And then guess what? I stopped going to as many meetings, right? Felt like at 7 years clean, you know, I didn't need to go all the time, right? My obsession had been lifted. I used to say that my obsession to use has been lifted. I believed it. I really believed it. I'd say, my higher power has thought fit to remove my obsession to use. Well, during that time, my obsession to use illicit drugs had been lifted. And I really did not have the desire to shoot heroin or smoke crack or do whatever. The obsession to use illicit drugs had been lifted. But my addiction was still very, very active. And my addiction was cunning, baffling, and powerful. It was very much working on me. So a drink is a drug, is a man, is a cookie, right? Illicit substances aren't the only way that my addiction wreaks havoc in my life. Illicit substances are just where I hit the worst bottoms, right? But well, I'll tell you in a minute, sometimes a spiritual bottom is a whole hell of a lot worse than you know what I mean, like a material possessions bottom, or like even a physically life-threatening bottom, you know what I mean, that we come to. Spiritual bottom is the worst, you know. So what happened, my sister and I were like, we looked very similar. People used to think we were twins, and we were traveling all over the country. We were going to world conventions and retreats and going to other states and conventions at beaches and just living a really, really good life, you know. And my sister relapsed. And because at year seven, my obsession had been lifted, right? And I wasn't going to as many meetings, and I was calling Murph like once a month sometimes. Has anybody ever called their sponsor like once a month? I did that. I lived that, you know. Not anymore. That doesn't happen for me anymore. So, my sister relapsed. This shook the foundation of my existence. For my sister to relapse was really, really hard on me. And my sister disappeared on a run. And I had to file a missing persons report, and I spent 3 months of my life sleepless, worried sick about where my sister was. I had no idea where she was. The state police couldn't find her. You know what I mean? It was a very, very trying period in my life. And I got a phone call at work one day about from the state police saying that they had found my sister. And I don't know how they found her. Oh, she had been arrested for something. That's how they found her. They found her in Butler, Pennsylvania. And they gave me an address of where she was staying. And I drove there. And I found my sister in a hotel room. It was a deplorable place, you can imagine. And Amanda had been, she was skeletal. She was smoking crack. You know, she hadn't eaten in like 6 months. You know what I'm saying? It was bad. She looked so, so, so bad. Oh, God. Just the image of her. Oh, see somebody you love in that state, you know. Really, really hard to accept that. So, I begged Amanda. I said, please come home. Please, like, I'm here. Come home. And she didn't want anything of it. She wasn't ready. She wasn't ready to come home. And I took her across the street to a Pizza Hut. And I bought her pizza. I was just like, eat, eat. I just sat there and didn't eat any of it. I was just like, please, like, eat. When we left, I bought two more pizzas, and I took them back to the hotel room, and I left the pizzas there for her. I was like, Nina, please eat. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. Like, it was like a desperate attempt, like your grandma sees you crying and they want to give you a bowl of ice cream or something. You know what I'm saying? It was like I needed something. I needed for her to feel my love. You know what I mean? And I wasn't reaching her with my words, and I wasn't reaching her with my hugs and my affection. And somehow I thought that the food that I was offering her would, like, jar her back to reality or something. And I left her there. I left my sister and Butler. Like, she wouldn't come home with me. And 3 days later, I got a knock on my door, like 3 a.m. I'm like, what the hell's going on? Woke up and I thought, it's the police. You know what I mean? Like, as I'm walking down the steps, it's the police. The police are there to tell me Amanda's dead. You know? And I opened the door and it was Amanda. So, you know, I guess the pizza spoke to her, you know? I don't know. The pizza worked. So, it was Amanda. And I opened my door. I said, Mandy Jane. And she came, and for the next 2 days, she was with me. And she was so sad. Oh, my God. You know what those coke runs do to us when the coke runs out? Oh, God. You know what I mean? The pain that she was in, really bad. So Amanda was there with me for 2 days, and she loved my babies, and on the third day home, I didn't want to talk about this. Why am I talking about this? Okay, on the third day, Amanda hung herself. And, it was very, very hard for me. It's still very hard for me. And suicide, survivors of suicide, that's a really, really hard thing to go to. Because the why will never be answered. You know what I'm saying? So, you know what I mean? If somebody's in a motorcycle crash, you know why they died. If they get cancer, you know why they died. If they're just really, really old and it's time to go, you know why they died. You know what I'm saying? With a survivor of suicide, the why, you live the rest of your life not without that answer. So Amanda hung herself, and it broke me. It broke me. I broke. I'm still, this is a lot of years later, I'm still super gluing some pieces back together, you know. And because I wasn't connected, because I was only calling Murph once a month, right? And because I was only going to my home group, you know, I went back to the, I'm feeling this kind of way, and I really don't want to feel it. I really don't like the way this feels. Surely I can't survive this. I will die from this healing. I know I will die from this feeling. And I wasn't connected, and I used. That's the only way that if I had been connected, if I was in contact with my sponsor or whatever, I know I wouldn't have. I know it. But as I say, that's part of my journey, right? Chronic relapse, 30 years of it. So I used, and I got through her funeral and everything. I don't even know how. And, I was pissed drunk at her funeral. And, so for the next 5 years I used. So in 2013, I came back to Narcotics Anonymous and I said, I need some help. I'm here for some help again, right? It was after a 5-year run, beginning with Amanda's death until 9/4/13. And that 5 years of my life is where I experienced the spiritual bottom. And it's unlike anything else and that I'd ever experienced in my life. And the spiritual bottom that I, the easiest and only way that I can really describe it is that I was just empty. I was hollow. I didn't lose my home. and I didn't lose my car, and I had children, and I had a career, and I was working. I had a really good job, and I was in grad school. Okay? So, like, on the outside, like, I didn't lose everything. And because of the hierarchy of drugs, right, I wasn't using the white powders, and I wasn't using a needle. I was taking pills. Okay? So the unmanageability in my life was not recognizable to me, and I couldn't see it. I didn't understand it, because the unmanageability in my life in the past showed up with me stealing electricity from my neighbors because my lights were out, right? The unmanageability showed up with me with homelessness, or waking up on a park bench in Chicago with no shoes on. That's the kind of unmanageability that I had experienced before. Very evident to me and to the rest of the world. Something wrong with this going here, right? Something's wrong. Right? This time, it wasn't evident because the unmanageability was in here, was inside. That's where the raging storm was, in the turmoil. And on the outside, I had all the trappings of a good life. And I volunteered, and I went to, you know what I mean? I did my thing, and I was working, and this and that and the other thing, and I was taking pills. And it started out that they were prescribed, right? So they were prescribed pills, right? It was sanctioned. A professional was telling me that it was okay to take these pills, right? Well, I took them as prescribed for maybe a week. You know what I'm saying? And then for the next 5 years, you know what I mean, every day was a hustle to get more and more and more of the pills. And I ended up eventually, the bottom of my head, oh my God, a spiritual bottom. I was buying Adderall off of children at bus stops, 7:30 in the morning. Children. I was buying drugs from a child. Do you see those kids over there? My kids, my twins, they're 11 years old. I was buying that children's medicine from them at a bus stop at 7:30 in the morning before they went on their bus and went to school. You guys, unbelievable. I had done some heinous, horrible things in my life. But nothing for me and my higher power and who I am, nothing touches the level of that depravity, right? But that's where my addiction takes me. That's where I go, right? So, spiritual bottom. For 5 years, I was empty. It was like the Tin Man, bum, 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 hollow. I can't hear anything. I walked around like a zombie. I was just so dead. I was dead. And it was Amanda. And Amanda, I'm like, why did you do this, Amanda? And please come back, Amanda. And just my whole entire life, I was obsessed with Amanda and the why, you know, that still won't ever be answered. And I couldn't get that picture of Amanda out of my head. In the hotel room, the night I bought her the pizza, and it kept me out there for 5 years. 5 years was bad. And on 9/3/14, I dreamt about Amanda, and I dreamt about her, and I saw her. It was in 2003 at the World Convention in San Diego. I was there, one of the best times I've ever had in my life, and I was playing football on the beach in San Diego with these men from, I don't know where they were from, like Kazakhstan or something, I don't know, and they couldn't speak a word of English, and we were laughing, we just laughed so hard that day, they could say, keep coming back, and so we would throw the football, and they'd catch it, and they'd go, keep coming back, and we'd all be like, ah! You know what I mean? We were just howling, like everybody on the beach, all these addicts playing football in San Diego on the beach, and the sun was shining and the wind, and Amanda and her hair, the curls blowing, and her laugh. I heard her laugh, and in the dream on 9/3/14, it was that day. I dreamt of that day. and I saw Amanda not in the hotel room, skeletal. I saw her alive, and I saw her with color, and I saw her spirit, right? And I saw her joy, and I saw her clean, and I saw the rewards of recovery, and I saw what the medicine of the 12 steps did for her, right? And that's how she came to me in my dream. And I woke up on 9/4/13, and I tried to will myself back to sleep. I was like, come back, Amanda, come back. And I forced myself to sleep, and I kept forcing and forcing and forcing, and I couldn't get back to sleep. And then I just went into autopilot, and my higher power took over. My higher power took over, and the next day, every action that I took was not my own. I just stood up. I realized that Amanda wasn't coming back to me, but I saw her on that day, and I knew that to honor her life, I had to be clean. And to honor my children's lives, I had to be clean. And to honor Odin detoxing as a baby in the bassinet in 1997, I had to be clean, right? I knew that on that morning on 9/4/13, and I woke up and I went to my side stand and I got my stuff and I got my pills and my stash of Adderall because I had to eat that shit like crazy, man. Stuff took me down like nothing else in this world ever took me down. So I dumped all my pills in the toilet and I pulled on some clothes and I got in my car, and it was a Wednesday, 9/4/13, and I was living in Westmoreland County at the time. I'd lost my house because of my addiction and to this Adderall, and I had to move to Westmoreland County, and I didn't know where any meetings were in Westmoreland County. That's not where my foundation was. My foundation was in Pittsburgh, right, in Beaver County, in Alacoppa, where I grew up. I know, like, the meeting list, like, I haven't memorized, right? So, from just so many years of coming around, and I was like, what day is it? Wednesday. I was like, do it now. Brownsville and Onyx, 12 o'clock. I got in my car, and I just drove to Pittsburgh. I knew there was a meeting at noon. And I got out of my car, and I walked up to the door, and Jenna M. was standing at the door. She had about a year clean at that time, and Jenna said to me, hi, how you doing? And I said, my name is Megan, and blah, 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 you know what I mean? And she was just like, okay, all right, you know? And Jenna hugged me, and she whispered in my ear, she said, you don't have to live like that anymore. She said, you don't have to live like that anymore. And I believed her. Right then, I believed her, and I knew I didn't have to. And I went to that meeting, and I got a key tag, and I drove home, and I went to a meeting that night, and I got a key tag. And that was 9/4/13. It was 3.5 years ago. So this year in September, I'll have 4 years. And I know it's probably past. Is it past time? Do I need to stop? Oh my gosh, it's right about time. Okay, I'll stop. I don't want to hold you hostage, right? You'll be calling in SWAT teams. We have a hostage situation here. You know. So, 9/4/13, my clean date. There are two things that are different this time, and I've identified what's different. Because when we come back in the rooms after a relapse, we have to do something different. Something different than the time before. Has to be different, right? Because I tried. If it's not different, then I'm just engaging in my insanity over and over and over and over and over and over again. So for 30 years, there was nothing different. Because I'd come back to the meetings and I'd say, I know what to do. I just need to do it. And I did. Go to meetings, you know what I'm saying, call my sponsor, work my steps. I know what to do. I just need to do it. And whenever people come in, I work in treatment, so many people come in and they sit across my desk and say, I know what to do. I just need to do it. Okay. Yeah. All right. And how's that work for you so far, right? You're in a fucking detox, right? So for 30 years, I knew what to do. I just needed to do it. So the difference is that in September when I came back, I had the benefit of being in a completely different area. For me, it's a curse because I had to move to the suburbs because of my addiction, consequence of using. I hate the suburbs. Hate it, right? I'm okay now. I'm rooted there, and I've got a nice community, right? But I'm a city girl, right? Very much thrive in the energy of the city, you know, so it's hard for me. But Swana, South Hills, or South Hills area, Shasna. South Hills area, it was my area for my entire life. And everybody knew Meg. And I would come back from a 2-year relapse and I'd be like, oh my God, Meg, it's back. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of rested on my laurels, right? I knew what to do and I just needed to do it, right? And, you know what I mean? With 3 days clean, newcomers were coming to me because I was an old timer, right? So, like, nothing changed. But here in Westmoreland County, I'd go to meetings and nobody knew me. Nobody knew that Megan had 8 years clean. Nobody knew that Megan had 2 years clean before. Nobody knew that Megan's first meeting was in 1986, right? Nobody knew that I was the babysitter at Double Bubble when they first started. You know what I mean? Like, people didn't know this in the South Hills area, I mean, in the Kiwanis area where I was at. And when I went to meetings in that area, I didn't tell them. I was just a newcomer, and I didn't know anything. I didn't say, I know what to do. I didn't tell them that I had worked 7 four steps before, really, really good four steps. You know what I'm saying? Like, really freed me up and changed my life, right? But I didn't tell them that. I said, I don't know what to do. I'm a newcomer, and I need some help. And I didn't tell anybody. And it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe like 2 years clean, I gave a lead. People in my area were like, what? Like, they didn't know. I didn't like, you know what I mean? Like, I was a newcomer. I was an empty glass. And that's different. And the second thing that's different is that I do not delude myself and lie to myself and say that my obsession to use has been lifted. The stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard. Dumbass. You're some dumbass shit in this world. That's one of the dumbest. And I say that with love because I said it for so many years and believed it. Believed it with every ounce of my being. I believed that my obsession to use had been lifted. I do not subscribe to that anymore. On any given day, you will find me shoveling cookies into my mouth at an amazing rate. Serious. That's addiction. Okay? My obsession to use has not been lifted. My obsession to use illicit substances has been lifted. My addiction is very active. Right? I don't smoke anymore. But I was a hardcore smoker, and I went hard with those cigarettes, man. One after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next. Yeah, my obsession to use has been lifted. What? Oh, fuck are you saying? You've got a cigarette in your hand. Your obsession to use has not been lifted. You're using right now, right? So that's different. And I don't say any of this in a judgy way. Smoke. It's okay. There will be a time in your life that it will be time to quit. It's going to happen. There will be that time. You know what I mean? Right now, smoke your cigarettes. I smoked for years. I'm not saying that to come off like in a condescending way. I'm just saying it to tell you my story and my experience. My obsession has not been lifted. It hasn't. It's very, my addiction is active every day of my life. And it is about using. That's another thing I hear people say. And I would say myself, it's not about using anymore. It's always about using. I'm an addict. It's always about, that's never off the table. It will be on the table forever until the day I die. So that's what's different. Right? And that's like, if you have relapse and you're just coming back or whatever, or you're back from a relapse or whatever, find something that's different and do something different, and then you'll have a real chance, you know? So with my two differences, you know what I mean? We'll see where this goes, right? Never in my life have I found the freedom that I've had these past 3 years with the two differences that I just shared with you. It's certainly been a game changer for me, and the rewards of my recovery are innumerable. But I'm gonna stop, right? Because it's been like an hour I've been talking, and if you guys who know me know I don't shut up. I'm like, you know what I mean? And that's that self obsession, right? You know, I'm so important. You gotta hear me. you know. But I'm just really, really glad that you asked me to speak, and I'm glad to be here. And it's a lovely day. And the picnic, the fundraiser for the event, I've been to the Journey Continues several times, and it's a wonderful, wonderful, a wonderful time. And I look forward to it this year, camping with this man right here. And his trunk full of steaks. I don't think I've ever seen more steaks in my entire life. He had a steak for everybody at that campground. My experience is that I cannot use successfully. My experience is that I am a chronic relapser. My strength is that I'm standing here today. I'm still alive, which is a miracle, because our relapses kill us, right? My strength is that a day at a time, I've managed to stay clean for 3.5 years, right? And my hope is that somebody here believes that they can do it too, right? That's my hope. Yes. So our message is hope, our promise is freedom. And I guess that's all I have to say. Thanks so much for listening.